The WTAE News and Public Affairs Department presents a special edition of Viewpoint, a conversation with the Vice President, the Honorable Hubert H. Humphrey. Now, here is moderator Dick Ford.
Excuse me, Mr. Vice President, for just a moment. Good evening. This is a special edition of Viewpoint with a very special guest, Vice President Hubert Humphrey, who is in Pittsburgh this weekend, of course, campaigning for the presidency of the United States. Since this is a special edition of this program, we have altered the usual format. Instead of having some newsmen converse with the Vice President, we've asked some college newsmen from our city of Pittsburgh, from the various colleges, to participate in this show and ask the questions. And they are Ms. Cheryl Oakes, the editor of the Chatham College Arrow, Don Marbury, feature editor of the University of Pittsburgh News, George Heidekat, the editor of Duquesne University Duke, and Thomas Cammons, the editor of the Carnegie Mellon Tartan, and Paul Stroller, who is the editor of the Pitt News. And Cheryl, since you are the young lady present, we'll defer to you for the first question.
Thank you. Mr. Vice President, many young adults have become alienated in their dissent following the events of the Chicago Convention. What constructive program would you offer to renew their faith in the American political system? And how would you use the resources of youth in this country?
Well, Cheryl, that's a big question. Before we go to that, I'm going to correct Dick over here. I think that's David Cammons, the last I heard.
I'm sorry, David.
I know that a number of our young people have been very disappointed in some of the activities that took place at Chicago. Both in the convention and outside. May I direct my attention to in the convention first, because that was where I was putting most of my attention. The fact is that the average age of the delegate to this Democratic National Convention was about 11 years, I believe, younger, between 10 and 11 years younger than at previous convention. There was a large influx of young people in that convention, and I believe I'd have to check the facts on this, but I read where it was substantially younger than our opposite party of the Republican convention. There was a good deal of youthful participation, or young people's participation, as delegates, as alternates. Now, some of those young people felt that because they didn't win on some issues, that it wasn't participation. But can I say, as one who has gone through at least being young and still feels somewhat young at heart, I have been in many contests that I didn't win. I didn't like it. I don't want to be misunderstood. But winning is not always participation. I mean, participation comes with both victory and defeat. There were many advances made in this convention that young people ought to feel very good about. We revised the whole body of rules of the Democratic Party. Never again will, for example, a governor or a state chairman be able to appoint delegates. They have to be elected, either through the caucus system or through the primary system. That within itself, I think, is very, very important. Now, you asked about the alienation. I would hope that young people would understand that the political process requires stick-to-itiveness, perseverance. That I used to tell my students when I was teaching that if you think politics is bad and corrupt and unclean, get yourself your own bar of ivory soap. I hate to put in a commercial here now, but get it and go on in there and clean it up. Don't stay on the outside saying, I don't like it and I won't participate. And I think young people are doing that now. I had many young people, and by the way, the average age of my campaign staff is 26. Now, some people say, well, that's too young. You better not say that. I was cautioned the other day after a show like this, and you shouldn't mention that. But I do mention it because young men and women today are very politically sensitive, very politically alert. Now, what do I want to do to involve them? I want them to feel that I need their counsel, that I need their advice, that I welcome their suggestions. If I become president of the United States, I will establish within the office of the White House a special office to deal with problems of youth, so that there are ways and means to contact the center of the executive branch of the government, not relying just upon each department. I've been chairman of the President's Youth Opportunity Council. That's dealt primarily with the problems of deprived youth, I mean of the needy and the ghetto and the rural, urban and rural slums. But I think we need, in government today, a much better inflow of ideas from the college campus, from the young people who are at work as well, not just those who are students, all the way across the board, and I would hope I could help on that.
Don Marbury of the Pitt News, question for the Vice President.
Thank you. Mr. Vice President, when a black American serviceman returns home, he in most cases finds that the very rights that he has been fighting for are really denied him at home. What are your views on this, and what do you feel can be done about it?
Well, my view is that if a black serviceman, that is an American who's black, served his country, returns home, he deserves every consideration that this country can give him, white or black. I mean, there must be, absolutely must be, equality of treatment. And in some areas where there has been long sustained prejudice, I think you have to walk the extra mile to make sure that that man gets a fair break. Now, we have established a system in the government where the man that is coming home is interviewed on his moment of arrival. And we try to match the man with a job opportunity. And I can tell you that the matching thus far has been, in the main, quite successful. I think we just have to start teaching our fellow Americans that you can't ask a man to serve his country in war or in the military, war or no war, to take on those sacrifices and those responsibilities and then treat him, when he comes out, as if he was an unwanted American. Our military, by the way, is very democratic when it comes to race relations. We've sort of got democracy upside down around here, you know. The military ordinarily you think of as authoritarian without too much regard for individual rights. But the military has insisted upon total integration, not only in the non-commissioned and the private and sergeant corporal and so on, but right up the line to the highest offices in the commissioned officer group now. Barracks are integrated. The feeding is integrated, the hospitals are integrated, same mud, same blood, I think you remember. Now, you can't ask a man to fight in an integrated bunker at Kaesong and send him back to a segregated neighborhood. You just can't do it. Now, what do we intend to do about it? Enforce the law. What else do we intend to do about it? See that people are brought to understand that it is good for this country for people to be treated on the basis of merit, not on the basis of how you spell your last name or how you look or whether you are black or white or fat or thin, but rather on the basis of your merit. Now, we have all kinds of civil rights laws. What you and I need to do is to get people to practice this, practice human rights, human respect, human decency. And I think this is the central issue, may I say, in this election year. I think we're going to make a great decision here as to whether or not this is really going to be one nation in which we have respect for each other, in which we live as neighbors, in which we live as fellow citizens, or whether it's going to be a nation apartheid, divided, whether we're going to have separatism or whether we're going to have unity. I really believe that. Now, we have one candidate in this country that talks very openly on the basis of race. We have another who surely is not a racist, but very frankly, I think he's made an unholy alliance when he joined up with Strom Thurmond, who represents like the most conservative and reactionary elements of republicanism in the South. I think that was a very costly and unfortunate alliance. And I think we're beginning to pay for it. I noticed, for example, Mr. Nixon said that he supported the 1954 Supreme Court decision, but he thought the methods of enforcing it were wrong. Well, now, you know, this is like saying that you like your wife, but you really don't think she ought to buy a new dress, she ought not to have money for groceries, and she really ought not to have a chance to join the club, and so on. Now, you can't have it, I favor this, but. That kind of politics gets you no place. That's the politics of confusion. I favor the decision, but. I favor Mr. Fortas, but. I favor the non-proliferation treaty, but. Now, people are going to start asking after a while, but what? And I think I know but what it's all about, and so do you.
George Heidekamp, Duquesne University, Duke.
Mr. Humphrey, today Mr. Nixon referred to your stand on, quote, law and order as naive.
Yes.
I've heard reference to this election as being an election for a sheriff. Exactly how do you feel the President of the United States should stand on law and order in the individual sitting?
Well, the first thing that the President of the United States ought to exemplify is respect for the law in his actions, in his words, and in his deeds. He also ought to exemplify respect for the institutions of law, like the courts, for example. I must speak very frankly about this. When candidates for the highest office within the gift of the American people start condemning the courts because of their decisions, then I began to wonder just what's happening around here. We have separation of powers. I would never want a president to be able to control the courts, and the American people spoke of this once before. When Franklin Roosevelt, I bring in my own party now, when he tried to, they called it pack the court, the people turned him down in the election of 1938, and the Congress turned him down. And I think that Mr. Roosevelt realized that was one of his serious mistakes. Now, Mr. Nixon is condemning the Supreme Court and its decisions. Mr. Nixon is condemning the Attorney General, who is the chief law enforcement officer of this country. Now, how do you engender respect for law amongst any people if you, first of all, take the highest court of the land and say that it's not doing right, you disagree with it, and not only disagree, that you demean it? And how do you engender respect for the law when you take the top law enforcement officer of your country and say that he's soft on this or that and doesn't seem to be willing to really crack down on lawlessness, even though the record shows to the contrary? Now, Mr. Nixon said to me that I was naive. I believe that was a word you used on law enforcement. Well, let me tell you, I was the mayor of a city about the size of Pittsburgh, and I was in charge of the police department. I appointed the chief and could remove him. I appointed all the captains and could remove them, and all the top officers. Now, my city was known as a city that had been infected by organized crime for some time. The way I became mayor as a very young man was to tell the people of that city, if you give me a chance, I'll break the back of organized crime in this city. We used to have riots on our streets, violence between labor and management. I said, I'm not going to let either labor or management set the pattern of conduct in this city when it comes to law, to lawlessness. I reorganized the police department. I brought in trained experts. I received the FBI award for outstanding police department. I trained my police department, or had that police department trained, in law enforcement procedures, in community relations, in human relations. I increased the size of the police department. I doubled the salary of the police officers. I reduced their work week from 52 hours to 40 and said to them that it was their job to enforce the law. And I believe that Mr. Nixon owes me an apology. There's been one apology come from the vice president on the Republican ticket, for which I'm grateful. Any man that'll go back and examine the record of the Humphrey administration as the mayor of the city of Minneapolis will come away with the unmistakable conclusion that law and order was the rule of the day, that law enforcement was the program that we gave to that city. I don't want to accuse anybody else of being naive about it, but you don't get law enforcement by just saying you're for it. I'll tell you how you get it: by backing up your police, by training them, by having experienced professional police officers. We don't recruit police in most cities on the basis of professionalism. We recruit them on the basis of their height, their weight, their age, and their physical fitness. In one large city in this country that I could speak of, there are 5,000 police officers, and 800 of them have less than an eighth grade education. Now, I think our police officers deserve public support, but they deserve something else. They deserve a training program. They're going to have one here in Allegheny County, a training institute. I was in New Jersey, where they have what they call Operation Combine, extensive training in race relations, human relations, community relations. What are the rights of the police officer, and what are the rights of the citizen? Many people say today, well, the courts have denied the police officer a chance to do his job. Not at all. You are a citizen. You're entitled to certain rights, and so is the police officer entitled. Now, I've proposed a program of law enforcement outlining how the federal government can strengthen our police departments. And by the way, if you want good law enforcement, you got to pay for it. Mr. Nixon didn't remind you of that. He apparently thinks you can get law and order by just calling for it. Finally, the president is not the man with the police power in this country, and you can be thankful for that. The governors have it, the mayors have it, the legislatures have it. Law and order is essentially a local proposition. I don't want a federal police force. We've got enough federal officers roaming this country already. And I think that with a powerful executive, if that executive was to have a federal police force, that many of your liberties might very well be in jeopardy. So Mr. Nixon doesn't seem to understand very well the whole process of law and order. He seems to feel that if you just say you want it, that it'll happen.
Now, I might remind him, and this is really rather irrelevant, but it's at least a factor, that of all the states, and the states have primarily responsibility for law and order, police power rests in the states under the 10th Amendment to the Constitution, as you all know. Of all the states where those states that have Republican governors seem to have more crime than those states that have Democratic governors. Now, what does that prove? I don't think it proves much, but if you want to throw things around, that's a fact. Now, maybe Mr. Nixon would like to talk to some of his own. I don't think there's a single governor in the United States that doesn't want law enforcement and law and order. I pay my respect to them. They got a tough job. I know of no mayor that doesn't believe that there ought to be law and order. But then I went on to say that it isn't just necessary to have more jails and more police, even though that is necessary to have adequate police. You've got to get at some of the root causes, too. Now, there isn't always a direct relationship between poverty and lawlessness, but the fact is that more crimes are committed in the ghettos than any place else. The fact is that more poor people are the victims of crime than anybody else. There is a causal relationship between poverty, deprivation, and all that comes with that, and crime. There isn't any doubt about it. And Mr. Nixon can pretend there, can say, all I wanted to do was to double the poverty program. I guess that's what he said I wanted to do. I wouldn't mind doing that. If I thought I could help somebody get a productive job, I think that's good. If I could help build neighborhoods, decent neighborhoods, I think that'd be good. I think this country needs more decent neighborhoods than it needs new penitentiaries. I think some of the old penitentiaries need to have some revision within them of their correctional institutional habits. We do a poor job of rehabilitating any criminal. 4 out of 5 criminals are repeaters. 4 out of 5. Now, if you really want to talk about law and order and not be naive, you better talk about how you're going to improve your police departments, the kind of training you're going to have, what you're going to do in these correctional institutions, how you're going to strengthen your narcotics enforcement service, how you bring together federal, state, and local cooperation. Then you start to understand what law and order is all about, what law enforcement is about. But to call a man naive, particularly when you haven't even as much as played marshal on a television show, much less run a police department, I think is rather ridiculous.
David Cammons, the editor of the Carnegie Mellon Tartan. David?
Mr. Humphrey, you were in Chicago when a great deal of trouble erupted, confrontations between people claiming the right of free speech and dissent, people claiming the duty of enforcing law and order. Now, I'd like you to comment on perhaps the limitations of free speech and open dissent on which the nation was virtually founded, and the need for law and order, which has been tossed around so frequently.
Well, I can give you a short answer that I think crystallizes my view. Dissent, yes. Disorder, no. Great deal of difference between a man getting up and making a speech, peaceful picketing, nonviolent demonstrations. That's within the democratic process. That is the right of assembly, the right of petition, the right of free speech, the right of free press. And none of those rights ought to ever be abridged, that is, ever denied, either by government or by a mob, or by government or by a handful of people who decide to take things into their own hands. I saw, for example, where one young man that was, I guess he said he was a militant, said that we could even expect trouble at the ballot boxes, that some of them would come in and sit down at the voting booths, and they'd have to be dragged out. Well, now, when you start to interfere with the election processes, you're getting right at the heart of the whole democratic process. Now, I don't think there's any doubt that when you get a confrontation between groups of people milling around, that people get hurt. The tragedy of the Chicago affair was that some of the people that got hurt were really just students that were there that got caught up. The people that were really planning the provocation, the people that really were behind it, they were way behind the scenes, sort of like a staff officer in a war. They didn't get up there where the landmines were and where the trouble was. They were way back. And many a young person got caught in and caught up. Now, somebody asked me, well, what do you do in a riot like that? My answer, get away. When things start to move like that, get away. I do not really believe that you can hold the mayor of Chicago responsible for the individual acts of a police officer. any more than you can hold Mayor Lindsay responsible for the riots at Columbia University. I'm sure he has nothing to do with them, and I'm sure that he can't be held responsible every day for what every police officer does today at Columbia and what they did yesterday. And I saw clubs being wielded left and right and people dragged out. All I can say is that we need to train our police so that they don't overreact. That's what I was trying to get at here a moment ago. Stern discipline on the one hand. And we need to have it clearly understood also that the processes of dissent do not include disorder to the point of combat or disorder to the point of open violation of the laws of civil peace. Now, finally, may I just add that it's very important for us to know that the people of Chicago did not get involved really in this. Most all the trouble that we had around there in Chicago, and I didn't see too much of it, I read mostly about it, I was kind of busy on some other matters. Most all of it took place in front of the Conrad Hilton Hotel and that park right out there in front. You could go a block or two away and it was as peaceful as could be. Now, why was it all there? Well, because there was the action headquarters of the political convention. What had been said about that? Some people had openly stated that they were going to break it up, that they were going to crash the convention, that they were going to move in and break things up in the hotel, and those were open statements. I've said before, and I must say it to you again, that two or three of us that were candidates were threatened with assassination. Now, we've had a couple of assassinations, one at Dallas, one at Memphis, one at Los Angeles. And let me tell you, if you're the mayor of a city, when the shame of assassination hits your city, when a president and a distinguished churchman like Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and a presidential candidate and a senator like Robert Kennedy are killed, you get worried when people say that you're going to have assassinations. And your government knew, and the Chicago Police Department knew, that two or three people had been threatened and their families with assassination. I hate to say that on a TV show, but it's a fact. And therefore, the police were very nervous, very edgy. And I noticed the first couple of days that things were pretty good. And then it got, the temperature got hotter and a great regrettable tragedy took place. And all I can say is I was a man of sorrow.
Another question from the man bringing up the anchor spot here, Paul Stoller, the editor of the Pitt News.
Mr. Humphrey, you just mentioned that no government should forbid democratic rights to its people. Well, I wonder if I might move to Vietnam and go into the situation of the Saigon government. And I think it's common knowledge that in South Vietnam, many of the freedoms are not practiced. And I would like to know how you or any American can reconcile our support of South Vietnam with this knowledge.
Well, we did not commit ourselves to South Vietnam, which, by the way, was not done by President Johnson or even by Vice President Humphrey. That commitment was made a long time ago, and once the trouble with some of these commitments is that when they come due, you're not quite sure what the bill is going to be. No one ever dreamed when we made the commitment that we did back in 1954, and later on again in 1956, and later on again in 1960. No one ever dreamed that those commitments would result in the involvement that we now find ourselves in, but nevertheless, that's what happened. And that's the danger of commitments. Or at least that's what I should say, if not the danger, that is that's the unpredictability of commitments. Now, the Saigon government is not the epitome of democratic institutions. I agree with you on that. But it has been an elected government with a large percentage of the electorate participating. It is a minority government, and I know that you recognize that it had about 35% of the vote, I think. And now with the new prime minister in, it has about 50% of the vote. But the minority governments, we had 11 of those in the United States. John Kennedy was a minority president. I mean, he didn't get 50% of the vote. We've had 11 presidents that had anywhere from 38% to 49% of the vote. Abraham Lincoln was not a majority president. He was a minority president. So that when we say that they didn't have a full base of support, I don't applaud that, but I say that it is not unusual. Now, the other thing I must tell you is they haven't had much experience in democracy. But let's consider what they have done. They did write a constitution. First, they did elect the National Assembly to write a constitution. We never did. Our assembly was appointed. they did write a constitution, and they wrote it in the full view of television and newspaper and radio people. Our constitution was written behind closed doors. Not a single reporter was ever permitted. They did repair a constitution, and it was ratified by the people. And it was accepted by the then, what they called directorate, the military directorate. People didn't, many of our people said that wouldn't happen. Then there were free elections. There were free elections, with the exception of the communists that were not permitted in that election because they were in open war, any more than in the election of the, in the period of time between the war between the states, that the votes of the Southern Confederacy were permitted in the election. There was open war. Now that election was participated in by over 80% of the electorate. Now, if we can get 80% of the American electorate to participate in this general election, it will be the greatest victory for democracy that the world that we've ever known. We generally get about, between 50 and 60%, maybe a few more, but let's give it between 50 and 65% of our total electorate that participates. Now, that government is far from being what I'd like it to be. There's corruption. That's not unusual in many countries. It has exercised poor judgment on many a case. For example, one of the leaders was arrested recently there. I think that I've condemned that. I think that was most unfortunate that that should happen, and he ought to be released, and our government has said so. But it is a government that is growing in democratic procedure. Let me give you an example. The National Assembly elected senators and delegates still meets. They did pass major law, mobilization law, Inflation Control Act. They passed a set up a separate directive for the prosecution of corruption. 26 province governors have been removed. 66 district governors have been removed. Hundreds of military officers have been removed and prosecuted for corruption. So the government in South Vietnam is better. It isn't what I'd like, but let's take a look at its enemy in North Vietnam. They never had an election. They just plain shot their way into power. Now, they had bullets, not ballots. They have never had a free press. And they have incarcerated I don't know how many people who have spoken out against the state. Now, two wrongs don't make a right. But what we're really trying to do in Vietnam, and I hope and pray that we can succeed at it, is to give them a shield of protection in South Vietnam so that they can have self-determination. I happen to believe that we ought to insist upon totally free elections for the election of the next government of South Vietnam, with everybody being able to participate who is willing to accept the peaceful processes of democracy.
If that is the case, would you support or recognize diplomatically the NLF if it won a majority in the free election?
Oh, yeah, listen, so that's self-determination. That's one of the risks that you have to take, who they elect. I've never known a communist to win a free election. I'm not really worried about that. That's sort of like having an old spavin horse in the Kentucky Derby. They generally don't win. But if it should happen, you'd have to accept that result if you believe in free elections. Now, I believe in one man, one vote. And more than that, I believe that all persons who are willing to accept the peaceful processes ought to be able to participate. Communists, non-communists, nationalists, the different religious groups, and let the people of South Vietnam select their government. Now, that's my position, and I believe that that's our government's position, by the way. And that's what I believe will ultimately lead to a better situation in Southeast Asia.
Mr. Vice President and panel, would you believe we're out of time? A very interesting and enlightening half hour. A special edition of Viewpoint. Our guest has been the Honorable Hubert H. Humphrey, Vice President and Democratic candidate for President of the United States. Thanks for being with us, and good evening.
This has been a special edition of Viewpoint, a conversation with the Vice President, the Honorable Hubert H. Humphrey. Viewpoint has been a special presentation of the WTAE News and Public Affairs Department.